For those of you who've been keeping track, I've been on the road for about a week now, so I'm a little bit sleep deprived. I was actually competing with Mike Shaver for style points. We were both supposed to speak in Monterey on Wednesday, and he gave his talk here yesterday. But he actually got someone else to do his speech in Monterey for him, so I think he wins on style points because he actually got to like sleep this week a bit, which is far different from me. So I'm Mike Ang. I used to work at Netscape for about a year total. I worked with some really cool people who are here today, who will no doubt yell and scream if I say anything that's incorrect. Since then, I worked at LinuxCare for a little while and been hacking Mozilla in my spare time, my copious spare time. But basically, the only work I'm doing now is fixing up all my remaining bugs from my year at Netscape. So I'll probably be hacking on Mozilla for many years to come. So today I'm going to be talking about XPCOM. And XPCOM is really one of the key technologies inside Mozilla, and it's really a core part of our strategy for having a modular code base. So I'm going to try and explain why XPCOM is important, why you'd want to use it, and why you'd want to learn all the rules of XPCOM. So I'm going to try and sort of talk about the problems that led to the creation of XPCOM, talk about motivations for making it, and then I'm going to actually start diving into the guts of it a bit, talking about interfaces, implementations, talking about how to actually create a component, memory management issues, because this is a often tricky aspect of XPCOM. We're going to talk about JavaScript interoperation, which is really cool. I'm going to show you how to do all this really hard stuff in C++, and then when we get to JavaScript, it'll be like really easy. I'm going to talk about debugging, because of course that's always very important, and I'm going to reveal some breaking news. So now I'm going to talk about the problems and motivations of XPCOM. Basically, the whole motivation behind creating XPCOM, the cross-platform component object model, is to try and create a programming environment where we can write software that doesn't suck. And one way that you can create software that will suck is to go with a monolithic approach, to go with an approach where you take all of your software, compile it all together at the same time, and end up with one huge like statically linked binary at the end. Of course, some in present company will point out there are some few uses for having monolithic software, but generally for user space applications, it's pretty much frowned on. Because the problem there, if you have this monolithic application, you end up with having very little code reuse because you've just got this one big blob and there's really nothing you can do with it. And it becomes very difficult for things like debugging. If your code is all, you know, one big lump, you have a problem. Well, which part of the application do you look at? You've got this huge blob to look at. So what we're going to try and do with XPCOM is create a model where we can build our application up from very small components. And these components will be able to all be separately compiled. You won't even need to link against the rest of the application to build your component. And so what this will do is it'll let you focus on a small area when you're trying to do implementation, and it'll also let you reuse your code because it'll be divided into much smaller pieces. Again, another reason why this is important is because if your application is made up of these small components, then someone else can come in and build one of those small pieces. And it's easier for them to come and build a small piece than to try and figure out what you've done in this, you know, massive spaghetti code and try and add something into that. And this was actually a problem that was very evident at the time of the Mozilla source code release back in 98. A whole bunch of people were looking at the source code, you know, trying to add their cool new feature. They just want to add, like, maybe it's just one more little button on a toolbar. They look at this code and they say, so to add a button, I need to look at layout, which interacts with the networking, which interacts with JavaScript, and none of those boundaries were very well defined, so it's very difficult to do this. And you know, maybe some hacker wants to add his one little toolbar, wants to spend a day on it. He'd look at this code and he'd just say, no, I'm not gonna spend the time and effort to try and figure out this mess just to add this one little thing that I want to add. So XPCOM is going to help us to, you know, make small components. It'll let hackers scratch their itches in a very short amount of time, so they're more likely to actually contribute code, and it's going to really help for third-party components. Another thing that XPCOM will do is it'll hide compiler differences, because we'll see that The interface and the implementation are separate, even down to a binary level. This isn't something that's true in C++, as I'll explain. And this is really going to help for third-party components again. And another thing that was a key goal of XBCOM was to increase the scriptability of the browser. One thing we wanted to do is really increase the use of JavaScript. In many cases, a scripting language is a very good choice of implementation language instead of C++ because it can be easier to debug, easier to read, faster to write. And so by dividing up the application into a whole bunch of small components, you can actually script those pieces together and create something that's very interesting and very useful. Whereas, again, if you had one big blob with maybe, you know, two functions available to JavaScript, that wouldn't be the case. And we'll see with XPCOM components, it's very easy to create a C++ component that can be used seamlessly with JavaScript. So now I'm going to talk about interfaces. And interfaces are really the sole way that you interact with components. Each component will describe that they will support certain interfaces. And this interface is basically a contract saying what what a component implementing this interface will do for you. And this is actually an abstract idea. There isn't really a concrete instance of an interface. And in C++, this is actually implemented as an abstract class. So IIDs are the way that you identify interfaces. They're interface identifiers. They're 128-bit numbers that are generated using a program called UUIDGen. It's part of the E2FS progs on Linux. Comes standard with Red Hat. There's one on Windows and the Mozbot IRC robot on the Mozilla IRC channel will also give you one if you ask it nicely. And so we have this component which will say, I have this interface. I can do these things. You can have multiple interfaces implemented on one component, and the way you choose between these is using query interface. This is very similar to doing a dynamic cast in C++. So what you give to query interface is that IID, that magic number, which will uniquely identify an interface. So I'm just going to show you an example of what an interface looks like. So this is an interface defining a Hello World component. All of the interfaces in XBCOM should be defined in XBIDL. That's the cross-platform interface definition language, which is, of course, used for defining interfaces which can be used cross-platform. And so all interfaces inherit from this base interface NSI supports. This provides the basic methods of XBCOM, which we'll be going into when we look at implementations. But for right now, we can just look at the methods of the interface. So you can see this first part. This interface is marked as scriptable, which means it'll be available to scripting languages. Basically, you pretty much always want to have your interfaces be scriptable. It means that you'll be able to access this interface from JavaScript and soon also like Perl and Python. And Java as well. But we didn't want to put that in as a default. There is a security against scripts using XPCOM maliciously in Mozilla, but we didn't want to make components scriptable by default. So you need to put that in just in case there was a bug in our security manager. Not that there have ever been any JavaScript security bugs in Netscape Communicator or anything like that. So the second thing you see there, that big, long, ugly number, is the interface identifier. We'll see there are also other more convenient ways of referring to the interface names. We'll see that there actually are, like in JavaScript, to access this NSI Hello World interface, it's just a property of a magic object, the components object. So you can see here we define the name of the interface, NSI Hello World, which inherits from NSI supports. And it has two things on it. It's got one method, which is say hello, which is going to do what you expect. And the other thing on there is an attribute, a string type, which is world type. In IDL, basically, you just have methods which can take and return types, which are standard to IDL. These are defined as standard cross-platform. Just the basic things you have like, just the basic things you have like, you know, integers, strings, that kind of thing. And attributes, as we'll see, will map to getters and setters in C++. An attribute, if you're familiar with JavaScript, you're probably more familiar with what an attribute would be like. It'd be like a property. So you can access it, getting it, and setting it. In C++, this generates magic functions for that purpose. And in JavaScript, you can also override those as well. So that was our interface. And what we use to compile that interface is XBIDL, this time in lowercase, which is the name of our compiler, which compiles capital XBIDL, which is the actual language itself. So from this language-independent interface, which we just saw, we're going to actually generate language-specific bindings. In C++, we'll generate header files, and then for JavaScript, we'll actually generate what's called a type library, which contains all the interface information. And so we've also got some macros that will be generated from that, which will help us to implement our component. And those macros actually won't contain any typos, so hopefully your implementation will be all right. So now we'll look at what is generated from this interface. So again, we've got that one method, say hello, and an attribute, world type. So what happens when we generate it, or when we compile our interface, it gets generated into this underscore xpidl gen directory, and we actually will get a header file, C++ header file, which corresponds to this interface. So we've got this generated stuff. So we've got that IID, the interface identifier, has been pulled out of the xpidl file, and is included here as a C++ define. This is the actual structure that represents it. And so now we actually find the class definition, which results from our interface. So we can see we've got this NSI Hello World C++ class now, which inherits from the NSI supports class. And this IID accessor is just an internal method, internal thing for XBCOM, just so it can retrieve that magic string from the object. And so we can see here that say hello method has been translated into a C++ method. And as you can see, all these equal zeros, what that means is that this is an abstract class. So it means that there actually is no implementation currently associated with this interface class. And because it is an abstract class, then the format of it is very well defined, because there's no actual implementation code here. So the format of this abstract class will be the same across all the C++ compilers that we care about. And we actually care about quite a few and a lot of old and crusty ones. So what this is going to mean is that we can access this from pretty much any C++ compiler that we want. And it will also mean that because there's no object code associated with this class, we'll be able to access this class without having to link against our component implementation. And at this point, I should probably say, if I'm saying anything that doesn't make any sense or that isn't clear, please just jump in and attack me, and I'll try and clarify. Some of this stuff really blows my mind, so it's okay if it blows your mind too. So you can see that world type attribute has resulted in two methods in our C++ class, get world type and set world type. And whenever that attribute is accessed, either from C++ or JavaScript or whatever, one of these two methods will be called. And the other thing that the XBIDL files can be used for is to generate online documentation. Currently, there's a tool called Doxygen, which generates this absolutely beautiful documentation with showing you all the interfaces that this particular one inherits from, where it's used elsewhere in the code. And that's all hooked up also with our LXR. It's a Linux cross-reference, which we're using on the Mozilla code, which is very useful for browsing the source code. You can do things like clicking on a class. It'll show you where it's defined and also every place it's accessed. And it's also really good for searching. So there are a couple gotchas in XBIDL for people coming from C++. There are a few things. You can't overload methods based on type or number of arguments. And the reason for this is because we need to support languages with looser typing schemes, such as JavaScript. So in JavaScript, it would be very difficult to overload a method based on type. So we don't allow that in XPIDL. This issue has come up before in the JavaScript to XPCOM, or sorry, JavaScript to Java connection technology, where we have these problems where in Java you can have these methods with, say, two arguments, and maybe one method takes two strings, one method takes two ints, and, well, from JavaScript it's kind of hard to figure out which one to call if you're trying to call from JavaScript into Java. So we simply don't allow that. That can be an issue if you're porting existing APIs to XPCOM. So now that we've looked at interfaces, we're going to talk about implementations. And just as we have interface identifiers for interfaces, we have class identifiers and what we call programmatic identifiers for classes. The CID is, again, a big magic number that uniquely identifies an implementation, and a prog ID is basically an arbitrary string that maps to CIDs, but there's basically very few guarantees when using prog IDs. Prog IDs are still sort of under discussion, the syntax for them, and exactly what they should mean, so that's one thing that's kind of changing right now. So one thing I should say, which is just to make sure it's absolutely clear when you get started, is that a given implementation can implement multiple interfaces, and by the same token, there can be multiple components which implement the same interface. I just say that because sometimes you'll see in the code, you'll see actually in the IDL file, you might see the class ID defined, which is actually incorrect because an interface is not associated with any actual implementation. So you should try and keep those abstract. So if we go back and look at the this generated header file from the IDL, we'll see we actually get some helper methods down below in this if zero block, which can be used as a template for helping to create our implementation. So what we'll do is actually use this code to create our Hello World implementation class, which I will show you right now. So in our implementation class, we need to do a few things. We need to define some of the memory-related parts of XPCOM. We need to define the methods of the NSI supports base class, and then we're also going to need to do our actual component implementation. So what I'll show you first is actually the query interface method, which is part of the NSI supports base class. And this one's a little bit hairy, but I guess I should preface this by saying the three methods I'm going to show you now can actually be done using this helper macro here, this impl I supports one. What that macro does is actually implement the methods of the NSI supports, and you just give it your base class, your implementation class name, and then the name of that abstract interface class. So here we can see query interface, and what this will do is when we're given an interface identifier, this method will basically return either, yes, I support this interface, and it'll return the object itself, or else it'll say, you have error down here, and it's no interface. So this part up here in the middle, I'm just sort of going to gloss over, just wanted to show you what it looks like. You can see here what we're doing is we get the interface identifier passed in, and then we check it against what we actually support. So you can see here we're checking, is the IID passed in equal to our interface ID? And if it is, then we will return this found interface. The only other interface that we support is NSI supports, because all components must implement NSI supports. And so if we get that IID passed in, then we'll also return our object. Otherwise, it's an error. So right there, we've just got some of our constructor and destructor junk. So skip now to the get world type method. So what we do when we implement that is we're actually going to return this string. So for now, all you need to know is that we're going to return the string. I'll come back to this method when I talk about the memory management stuff, because there's some stuff we need to do here. Similarly, for set world type, where we just copy in a string. So I guess this is probably the most important method of all on our Hello World sample component. We've got a printf in there, which is actually going to say hello to the console. So now I'll show you what creating that interface looks like. So what I'm going to run now is what's called the XPC shell. What it is the XPC stands for XP Connected Shell. So it's a JavaScript shell which can actually access XPCOM. And so it's actually very useful for debugging because it's pretty lightweight. It's very quick to load up, as we'll see. And it's really a lot of fun. So what I'm going to do is create a new Hello object. And from JavaScript, there's some helper objects. This is the magic components object, which is basically JavaScript's point of access into XPCOM. And what we're going to do here is access our sample component using the programmatic ID. It's a string. And this is our programmatic ID. And I'll explain how these programmatic IDs are registered in just a bit. So what we're going to do is we're going to create an instance of that using that call there. So now if we look at hello, this is just saying it's an XP Connect wrapped NSI supports. So currently what we have is not the interface that we want. It's actually that generic NSI supports interface. So if I look at the methods and properties of that hello object that I've got now, we'll see all I have is query interface. So that's not really what I want. What I want to have is the NSI hello world interface, which we defined before, which has that hello world method on it. So what I'm going to do now is actually query interface for that interface, which is similar to a dynamic cast in C++. So if we give it this, so what I'm saying now is, I could just type, I want to get that hello world interface, and that is now successful. So now if I do that same listing of the objects, properties, and methods, we can see we've now got that say hello method, which we will call just to prove that it works, because I'm sure you all doubt that it's possible. Right, so now we can see that we can say hello. So now what we're going to do is set that attribute that we defined. So what we're going to do is set the attribute using the JavaScript syntax, which is just simply to do the object dot property name. And we can do that. And so now, if we call that say hello method now, we get hello cruel world. So just to flip back to those two methods in here, just to point out what they get defined to, we can see that get world type, which returns a pointer to a string, that's what gets called when we do property access from JavaScript. So our C++ method is actually being called from JavaScript and returning that string, which is being printed out. All right. So we've already gone over some of this of what we need to do to create a component in C++. We've seen you define your interface in XPIDL, putting whichever methods you want on it. You need to generate that interface identifier. From that, you compile the XPIDL to generate C++ header files, and then you implement one or more of your interfaces. You actually implement all of your interfaces, and you need to have at least one or more because you need to have query interface. We'll also see that in able to load your components automatically, we'll need to create a factory, which is very easy, and you need to put your your factory and your component in the right place, which is, for Mozilla right now, is the component's bin directory. Right. So before going on to memory management, just have a quick look again at the query interface. Just to say again that we need to be able to pass in interface identifiers and then return the right object. So for this simple example where we just implement one interface other than NSI supports, it's pretty easy. But if you want to implement multiple ones, it's, well, also easy. You just basically keep on copying those lines, and you can use the macros, which are defined in NSI supports utils.h. Okay, so on to memory management. So if we look again at our JavaScript, if you're looking at our example of accessing using JavaScript, it's actually quite similar from C++. So we saw that we currently have that hello object, which is a pointer to that using the NSI interface. And so in C++, you don't actually obtain pointers to objects per se. You obtain what we call interface pointers. And so right now we can consider that hello is a kind of a NSI hello world pointer. And what we can do is create other pointers doing a query interface on hello. So if we want to say get another access using the NSI supports interface, and if I could type, remarkably I'm actually paid to type, but it doesn't seem to do me much good. All right, so now we have one object. Now we have one reference, hello, which is of NSI hello world type, and now we have another object, support, which is using the NSI supports method. So this is actually from JavaScript, so we don't have to worry about dereferencing null pointers and stuff because the JavaScript garbage collector takes care of all that. But you can imagine in C++, we could attain multiple pointers, multiple interface pointers to the same object. And so it becomes difficult to know when to free this object, right? Say if you've got five different places in the code where you're accessing the same implementation object using different interface pointers, when do you call free or when do you call delete? Which is, of course, a problem in any programming environment. But in XPCOM, because we have multiple interface pointers potentially, it's particularly bad. So the partial solution is to use reference counting instead of explicit calls to new and delete or free and malloc. So the way reference counting works is that the reference count of an object generally starts at zero, and each time you get an interface pointer to it, so each time the number of users of the object increases, you increase the reference count by one. And then once you're done with an interface pointer, you call release, and that decrements the reference count by one again. So once your reference count reaches zero, in theory, hopefully in practice as well, there's no one using your object, and then you can free it. I should say reference counting isn't a panacea. It's not. It's no substitute for having a real ownership model. And what we've seen, what tends to happen in XPCOM using reference counting, is that instead of freeing objects too soon and getting seg faults and stuff like that, what happens is we end up with objects that are just never freed, so they're leaked. You might think briefly that that's better than having a crash because something's been freed too soon. But then people who work on things like embedded devices will actually yell at you. And I'm not speaking from experience at all. Reference counting is pretty useful, but again, it's no substitute for a real ownership model. So you do need to still think about ownership issues when you start your coding. So for example, if you had some sort of tree object that had nodes and child nodes, then the parent node should own the child node and not vice versa. Because with reference counting, it's also possible to have cycles where objects will never be freed. And one thing we're thinking about as a future enhancement to XPCOM is to actually add a garbage collector. So if there are cycles, then those could be noticed by the garbage collector and freed. But currently, you're pretty much on your own using adref and release. And so you really need to think carefully. This is one of those kind of this class of problems where it's just like you either need to do something or not do something, and then everyone has to agree, right? So there are a few common patterns that we see, a few common guidelines you can apply for reference counting. And that is for in parameters in your method, you can assume those live for the lifetime of your function call, but no longer. So it means if someone passes you in a data buffer, for example, and you want to hold on to that for a long time, you actually need to make a copy of that or a call adref on what's passed in to keep your own local copy. And that's in case the caller decides they don't need it anymore and they free it. You'd be in trouble if you didn't have your own local copy. For out parameters, the caller becomes the owner. In XBCOM, we describe interface pointers as owning references because it means that the person who holds the reference is an owner of the targeted object. So it means that they're still using it, and you know, XBCOM won't be able to free the object until there are no more owners. And for in-out parameters, ownership needs to be shared. And so that means that for parameters passed in, and you want to keep it around for a while, you should call adref. And if you're going to change the parameter, then you need to call release on the old one and then call adref on the current one. And there's some examples of these kinds of things in the current code base, but you need to kind of be careful because they're not always correct. So I'll show you examples of in and out parameters in that our C++ implementation using those two get and set functions, which are up here. Actually, I'm lying. They're down here. So we can see for get world type, what we're going to do is because we need to return this string to JavaScript, and we're not sure what JavaScript's going to do with it, or any other C++ client for that matter, we need to make a copy of our internal data member. We've got this internal mWorld type, which is our internal copy of a string, and we want to return a copy of that. And so we could just call like malloc, but then we have this problem where we need XBCOM to interoperate with other scripting languages, particularly JavaScript right now. And so JavaScript has this whole other way of dealing with memory management. JavaScript uses garbage collection, so we can't just malloc a string and give it to JavaScript because, what's JavaScript going to do with that? It's difficult to maintain these memory ownership relationships across the JavaScript XBCOM boundary. So our solution to that was to use a global memory allocator that has knowledge of both C++, XBCOM, and JavaScript. And so still the familiar calls, malloc and free, it's just you need to go through this global allocator, which is this NS memory global object, and we call allocate there to allocate our memory. And so what this means is that the string copy that we make, we pass it to JavaScript, and the NS memory allocator will just take care of all the magic for us. We don't need to worry. The string will be garbage collected when it's no longer in use in JavaScript, and everybody's happy. So here we can see for set world type, we get passed in a character buffer there, a world type. So we do some minor checks in here. What we're going to do is create a copy of that passed in argument and store it locally. So we need to free our old internal string if it was there, and then here we can see that we just do a duplicate. And here, because we're only going to be using this string internally, we're not going to be passing it to XBCOM or to JavaScript. We can just use the normal string duplication routines. We don't need to call that global allocator. And in fact, it's less runtime cost to do it this way. Okay, so I've talked about the NS memory allocator, talked about adref and release, and I'll just briefly mention now the NSCOM pointer, because if you were going to do some XBCOM hacking for real, you probably want to use the smart pointer class. And NSCOM pointer handles a lot of stuff for you. It's actually quite cool, very well tested, very stable. And what NSCOM pointer lets you do is use this smart pointer class to wrap your your references, your interface pointers, and it'll do things like automatically calling addref and release as the pointer goes in and out of scope. For example, when I say here we need to use addref and release, I'm talking actually about real method calls on the object, and so that has no knowledge of whether you're local to a function, whether you're going to go out of scope, and so it can actually be a pain sometimes. The NSCOM pointer class will help a lot. So say if at the beginning of your function you want to get this interface pointer, you just use NSCOM pointer, and then when your function exits and the COM pointer goes out of scope, it'll automatically call release for you. The COM pointer class also helps for doing things like query interface. So now I'm going to talk about XPCOM and JavaScript interoperation. And the technology we use for that is called XPConnect. It used to be called XPCOM Connect, but that sounded even worse. So right now it's the XPConnect. And the great thing about JavaScript is that we don't have to do any of this addref and release nonsense. Because JavaScript is garbage collected and because it knows about XPCOM, all we need to do is create our objects, use them until we're done with them, and then just forget about it. We don't have to do anything. So as we saw in the example from XPC Shell, we're using those objects. And in JavaScript, well, when you're done, you just stop using them, and everything magically happens for you. And one thing that's worth saying is that almost all of the major interfaces in Mozilla are defined in XPIDL. This has been a really ongoing effort, and there's been a huge commitment to modularity and the use of XPCOM. And so it means that from JavaScript, you can actually do almost everything you could do from C++. And JavaScript can actually be often a very good choice of language instead of C++. And so right now, for example, the Mail News client is written about 10% in JavaScript, and the whole Mail News client is scriptable. So this is going to be really, really interesting because it's going to open up development to a lot more people. There's a lot of people who don't really want to look at all this C++ stuff under the hood, but who would be comfortable using JavaScript. And this is going to let them really start doing some interesting things. One application that's been done this way is the Chatzilla IRC client, which we don't have a network right now, so unfortunately I can't demo that. But it's pretty cool. What it does is it's almost entirely written in JavaScript. It calls into the Mozilla libraries using XPConnect to obtain a network socket using Mozilla's networking library. And then it actually does all the IRC protocol handling in JavaScript, which is pretty neat. And it's actually not a bad way to do it, because for IRC, you don't really need super speed. And doing a lot of the text processing is really cool in JavaScript, because you've got access to regular expressions that are basically a copy of Perl's. It's also possible to implement components in JavaScript, which is kind of cool, because it means that when you're accessing a component, you don't need to think about which language it's implemented in. It can either be implemented in C++, JavaScript, and there's also support for Perl and Python and Java on the way. So we'll just have a quick look at a component implemented in JavaScript, just to kind of whet your appetite. And the other thing about running a component in JavaScript is you don't have to worry about some of the registration stuff that I've so far glossed over, but we'll talk about it shortly. So we can see here, I should show you first, actually, the interface that this is going to implement. It's actually a different interface. This interface is just a sample interface, implements one attribute, value, write value, and a method called poke. And we can see here, these are the getter and setter functions in JavaScript. If you remember our C++ example, we had to use the NS memory allocator to do some copying. We had to worry about freeing strings. In JavaScript, it's pretty simple. We just assign to our internal value, and the JavaScript garbage collector will take care of getting rid of that when we don't need it anymore. So you can see here, writing a value, we've got just some other implementation. probably one of the more important parts here is this query interface. And so we can check, here again, we check against those interface IDs passed in, and we return errors similar as in C++. And here we can see we actually throw an exception. This is a JavaScript exception here. And in C++, exceptions are actually forbidden because it's not portable. We have to compile Mozilla on a lot of different compilers, a lot of really old compilers. And so if you look at the Mozilla portability guidelines for C++, you'll see there's this huge list of things you can't use. It's like, well, you can use C++, but you can't really use templates or exceptions or, you know, all, and it just goes on and on. But we can actually use exceptions now in JavaScript. So the reason that I was just been going on about this is just to show that JavaScript has a lot of the features that you would want in a robust programming language. It's got exceptions, and you can do all sorts of really cool things. Another thing is that any XBCOM error return codes will actually be mapped into JavaScript exceptions. So if you're calling into XBCOM through XBConnect and there's a problem, you can catch it using an exception, get a nice error message, and the whole deal. So we can see this whole thing here is that implementation of our that whole thing is our implementation of the object. So I'm going to talk now about how you implement your object in C++. So now we've seen how to implement your object in C++. How do we get it registered? How do we get it into the Mozilla runtime? Okay, so if we look at our sample code again one more time, we've got our sample code. It implements those methods. It's a short little file. How do we get our component into the Mozilla runtime? How do we make it accessible to people using Mozilla? And what we have for that is we've got what's called the component manager, and that basically is used to find which components are loaded, to ask for components, create instances of components. And so when someone wants to use your component, they will go to the component manager and say, make me a component of this type. And the way they specify that is using the class ID and also the interface ID. So here at the bottom, I've just got an example of how to create a component in C++ using the component manager. This isn't actually part of our implementation. I just put in that file just to access it easily. So the important part here is we can see we're going to ask the component manager to create an instance of our component. That this here is the programmatic ID. It's a string which will be mapped into the class ID. And the syntax for these is, again, still under discussion, but common syntax currently is vendor. That's just my vanity domain. Then the class name hello world, followed by a version. And the other important part here is the we ask for it also by that IID. So this is this part here, the programmatic ID. That'll be mapped to the particular implementation, and asking for this interface will cause it to be automatically query interfaced to the correct interface that we want, and the result is stored here in this variable. And so then we can see from C++, once we have the interface pointer, it's very simple to call the methods. It's just exactly the same way as you would call it on a normal reference. And so we can see that this create instance is going to create a new copy of our object, so it'll be addrefed. And then once we're done with it, we need to call release. So what I'm going to show you next is the magic that's needed to register with the component manager and to allow the component manager to create instances of your object. So when a client calls this create instance, the component manager is going to look up in its global table, and then it's going to use that to map the prog ID to a class ID, and then it'll use that to actually create an instance of your component. So to do that, we need to create what's called a generic factory. And the generic factory is what's going to be used to actually create instances of our component. The reason we need to use factories is, again, the problem of needing to link against libraries to use them. By using a generic factory, we're actually going to be able to use object code compiled by other compilers without ever needing to link against it. So it means problems like different name mangling in different compilers are going to be avoided. And so what we do, the way we do this is by creating a generic factory, and it has very specific entry points that are used by the component manager to call into it, and so these aren't subject to the C++ name mangling. So now we've created our component. Creating our generic factory using the macros is actually quite simple. This here says we're going to have declares which constructor we want to use. So that means that this generic factory will create our component using the default constructor for NS Hello World. So if you just switch back to that, it just means that our default constructor here will be called by the generic factory. So it's pretty reasonable. Next, we define this components array, which is used to declare which components this factory will be able to implement. And you can actually have multiple components serviced by one factory. So say if you've got 100 components, you can just put it into basically one DLL, which contains the code for your generic factory, and that can create instances of all those components. So this will be used to register with the component manager. We can see we use just a text description of our component. We're going to register with our class ID. That's that 128-bit number. Also with our prog ID. These are both defined in our header file. And this constructor, NS Hello World constructor, is defined by this macro, which we'll forward to our actual object constructor in our other implementation file. These two slots here, which are null currently, can be used for any specific registration and unregistration code you need to do. So there are other things you can do, like register into categories, which are ways of grouping related components, and you can use those two slots to have callbacks to do that stuff for you. And so now the big line here is NS implement NS get module, and again, just another text description, and then using that components array. And so what this will do is it'll define the entry points for your module, and it'll do all the magic you need. So now that we've done all that, we end up with an object file, a dynamically linked library. If you look at the make file, there's some make file magic in here, but if I find the linking line here. So in order to compile our component in our generic factory, we just need to link against these four libraries. These are just basically the XBCOM specific libraries, data structures, and I/O. The XBT info is used to load interface info, which I'll talk about in a sec. And that MOS registry is just used internally by the component manager, so we need to include that as well. And so that will all end up. We end up with like a libsample.so, which includes both our component implementation code and our generic factory code generated from that macro. The problem is we're still missing the interface information because we've got this now we've got this object code, but we still need the interface information. And so what we do is we compile the XBIDL again, and we generate what's called a type lib, which is actually a binary file containing all the information from the interface. And the reason we do this is so that information can be accessed from JavaScript as well as C++ or whatever other language bindings you need. So after doing that linking, we end up with two files, our .so and our end up with a .so and a typelib file. Let's see. And so we get these two files, the .so and the XBT, which contains the interface information as used by the runtime. All we need to do to get our component loaded is to copy those two files into a magic directory, currently components bin. And then when Mozilla starts up, it'll actually scan those two. It'll scan that directory, notice any changed files, and it'll automatically load your component. You can also trigger this manually by calling through an API. And what's interesting about this, and what's really cool about this, is that you can do this at runtime. So It means that Mozilla could be running. I could say, hey, I want to write some component now. Go and write a component, and I could have it loaded into Mozilla without ever having to even stop the application. And I could call into my component without having to do anything else other than calling that API. Yeah?
Do you have to worry about adding new interfaces?
No, because we've got these XPT files, those can be read dynamically at runtime too, so you can even add new interfaces. You'd have a problem there from C++, because from C++ you need to know about the interface beforehand, because you need to generate that abstract base class. But from JavaScript, you could even access that without having you could access that without having to do anything else. Yeah. That's right. That's right. If we saw in our JavaScript file, we've got a factory implementation here. Down here, all this stuff, this var my module. At startup time, it scans that bin directory, looks for JS files, and if they have that module and this method register self, this method register self will actually get called. And we can see here, we access the component manager, and we actually register our component. And so in the other one, we had to do some stuff to implement our factory, and this basically does a job here in JavaScript. Okay. One other thing I should mention is that the actual bindings that are generated from XBIDL in JavaScript and C++ have different capitalization syntax. So if we look here, this isn't a good example, but if we look in the IDL file here, we can see that we have this thing called say hello, lowercase s at the beginning, and then in our C++ file, it ends up becoming capitalized, and in JavaScript it's just passed unchanged. And the reason for this is because of just the existing conventions in C++ and JavaScript. But it's just to warn you of one thing that could trick you up. All right, so debugging. As we've seen, we can write to the console using our standard I/O stuff, printf, that kind of thing. We can use JavaScript console. This will report JavaScript errors. You just access it using tools, JavaScript console. This has been a really big requested feature. So you can see there's some error. I'm not sure exactly where that's from that has occurred. So you can use that to see your JavaScript errors, and you can also write to that console as well. XPC shell, that's what we've just been playing with our JavaScript example. It can be very useful when you're just starting out, trying to figure out what's going on, is your component being registered? Because of that, components object has some interesting properties on it. We can use these to find out information. So we can see we've got this interfaces is a list of all the interfaces that are there, classes, list of all classes, and then we've also got some other stuff which is related to JavaScript errors through XP Connect. So one thing we can do is find out a list of all the registered components. And so this is actually going to give us a list of all the prog IDs that have been registered with XPCOM. So we can see there's all these image converters, for example. These are using the old style prog ID syntax where you start with components, have some stuff, naming your class or thing, and then you've got this sort of parameterized thing at the end. We're sort of moving away from that. There's some proposals on the Mozilla XPCOM news group about changing that. And so you can scroll through and find your registered component, or you can say, for example, use a JavaScript regex to look for your component. So again, very useful if you're trying to do stuff actually inside the browser, it can be difficult. You know, you try and access your component and it says, well, I couldn't find it. You can use XPC shell to see if it was registered, to try different things on it. You can do that interactively, and it's useful for quick debugging. That's the wrong one. Also, memory tools. We've got some memory tools which will help you detect leaks. On Unix debug builds, it's pretty much as easy as defining some environment variables. And you get these huge logs containing all your add ref and release calls, and you can run a Perl script on that which will actually help you to detect leaks. It'll say, these five people add ref'd you, these four people released you, and then you can go find out who to beat on to fix the leak. So that can be very useful. And in terms of breaking news, there's a Mozilla 1.0 architecture freeze coming up relatively soon. The idea here is to sort of lock down a lot of the APIs so that third parties can start doing development on Mozilla. A big complaint among third parties is like, yeah, I wrote this great application using Mozilla. It worked last week, but now you changed something, so it's broken. So we want to try and minimize that because it's painful for everyone involved. So we're going to actually freeze some of the APIs. That includes the plugin API. Something neat about the plugin API is that it's now one of the plugin APIs is going to be defined using XBCOM. So your plugin will just be a regular XBCOM component. And this is going to be a major win because a lot of the previous problems with plugins were, you know, we'd compile with certain flags to GCC or whatever, and then a third party would compile with something else, and then you'd end up with runtime problems. So because we're using XBCOM, it's going to be a big win there. We're freezing a lot of the XBCOM, like data structures, base interfaces, the embedding API, and also the DOM. The DOM is kind of this strange thing, because the DOM has its own interface definition language, which is used to generate C++ code, which is like JavaScript stub code. So instead of using these XPT files to allow JavaScript to call XBCOM at runtime with basically no disk footprint cost, we generate these huge C++ functions, which can be called from the JavaScript C engine. And so hopefully that will be eliminated sometime soon, but for now we're just freezing it so people can use it. Also, ActiveState has announced that it's going to be working on Perl and Python connection technologies for XBCOM. And the neat thing about this is that they're going to work on connecting Perl to XBCOM, but that also means that because there's JavaScript to XBCOM, you'll be able to call from Perl to JavaScript. So instead of having four languages with this, you know, having four different, you know, having n ways of connecting between them, if you want to have interoperation between two languages, you just need to do that language plus XBCOM plus the other language and XBCOM. So that's going to be pretty wild when people can start implementing stuff in Perl and Python and JavaScript. It's just going to be really cool. We'll see how it goes. It could make debugging kind of interesting. And also, Sun is working on Java XBCOM connection technologies, and that seems to be progressing well on Windows and Solaris. So these are just some additional information, and just open up for questions, and if you have any other just general Mozilla questions, I'll do my best to sing and dance. Thanks. Any questions? Yes. Cross-process. There's someone working now on XML RPC for XBCOM. It's actually not that bad. We currently have cross-thread marshalling using a NSI proxy object. And so if you want to do cross-process, you basically just need to create a proxy object that'll do the marshalling for you, and then you're good to go. We have Mozilla.org, and people working on it right now haven't put too much emphasis on it. But again, there's someone working on XML RPC, and it's not too hard to do. Yes?
Where do those crazy object identifiers come from?
I'll show you. They come from here. UIDGen. And it's as easy as that. And you can make as many as you want, and they're guaranteed to be unique. The way those are generated is they take your Ethernet hardware address typically, plus some hash of the time, and a few other random things for goodness, and then they go. These are actually used a lot in like Word documents. So the Melissa virus guy, he sent this document out which had a UUID. These are called UUIDs, and it conveniently had his Ethernet address encoded in there. So if you're ever sending out Word documents, and probably not too many people here do, but if you are, then you're sending your Ethernet address too. Hooray for privacy. Any more questions? No? I have stickers. Will that make you happier than my talk? All right, well, thanks.